Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available online at carthage.edu/grad.
Today's morning show begins with the conclusion of the conversation begun yesterday with Wendy Paris, talking about the possibility of a positive divorce in her book, Splittopia. In part two of today's program, Trevor Cromolino talks about the challenges of blending families together. Trevor Molino not only brings professional expertise to the topic, but also personal experience, having been step-parented and having been a step-parent as well. Stay with us for today's morning show. We're speaking with Wendy Paris, author of Splittopia, Dispatches from Today's Good Divorce and How to Part Well. This is a fascinating book which explores not only Wendy Paris's own personal experience with divorce, but also it is a careful examination from many different perspectives and angles. And one learns through the course of this book that there is no right way to divorce, that all divorces are their own experience unique to the people involved, and yet there are certain principles that can really make a difference in at least many, many cases. She also spells out the fascinating history of how divorces once were conducted in our country, and how in the new landscape in which we live, the divorce can be viewed differently, and in a sense, much more positively than once was possible. Wendy Paris, one of the things you point out is that one reason why women in particular often dreaded the very notion of divorce, even divorce from somebody who was, you know, maybe a monstrous husband, is the fact that in many cases it might mean the very real possibility of falling into terrible poverty, in a sense trading one nightmare for another. And you say that at least one of the reasons why there is this fear is that certain studies, and a landmark study in particular, was done that spelled out such a reality in very dire terms. A study which turned out to be terribly flawed. Say a word about this study and about what the actual picture, in fact, should be.
Yeah, this is kind of an amazing fact. There was a study done by a Harvard sociologist that looked at, it was a group of women who divorced in Los Angeles. And the study purported to show that these women lost two-thirds of their standard of living after divorce, and that the men had, their standard of living was raised by a third or a half. And this was done in the late 70s, and she published a book about it in the 80s. And this was just, you know, just at the time when feminism was really going and women were realizing that they'd been shut out of the workforce and, you know, marginalized and not given opportunities. So this study became one of the most cited stats of the 1980s. You know, women lose two-thirds of their standard of living, and men are, you know, riding high in divorce. And other sociologists at the time who were using kind of similar data said, this doesn't look right. And they tried to reach her, and they couldn't contact her, and she wouldn't answer. And this went on to be sort of the gospel. And President Clinton quoted the study, and I spoke to Barbara Ehrenreich, who said, oh, I quoted that study. You know, this. So finally, she gave a New York sociologist permission to look at her records. This was like in 1996, and he recalculated, and he found that using her own data, she had flipped her findings, women retained two-thirds of their standard of living. They didn't lose two-thirds of their standard of living, but she saw what she was expecting to see. And he wrote about this in a sociological review, and she issued a retraction. But, you know, as I say, like, who reads sociological reviews? It was a retraction. We still believe this to be true. And then I quote this book called Divorced Dads, Shattering the Myths by Sanford Braver, where he talks about this whole thing, the sort of whodunit of trying to figure out, trying to reach the sociologist and get her data and, you know, figure out what was going on. And so he talks about how that two-thirds, you know, women retain two-thirds of their standard of living, that's not really, a hard fact either, because, you know, say the woman stays in the house and the man lives, you know, moves to an apartment, how do you calculate that? Or, you know, maybe the man is paying for, you know, sporting equipment or dinners. It's, you know, exactly who pays what is complicated, and there are some, you know, online programs now to help you keep track of exactly what you're paying to avoid fighting. But so this idea that you're going to go broke has to do with, in the past, before women could work or own property, and, you know, you really did need to be protected by a man. But also this realization in the, you know, in the 80s that women had not been given an equal, you know, an equal chance, then augmented by this totally faulty study.
Mm. And I think there's a similar story can be told when it comes to the way children are affected by divorce, that there have been isolated studies that seem to point to very, very high levels of trouble for the children of divorce compared to the general population. And for that matter, studies showing, you know, high levels of unhappiness for the adults involved. And those are also studies which, at least to a large extent, seem to have been discredited or trumped by more recent studies that paint a much more positive picture. Actually, what is the difference? Is it that these studies were flawed, skewed to create a certain reality that had, in a sense, been determined before the study even began? Or is it that the reality is different, that once upon a time, divorce was more traumatic, more painful, leaving more lasting scars on children, and now, for a variety of reasons, has the potential to be not only undamaging, but even a positive experience?
That's a good question, and it's probably both. It's one particular study, again, from the 1970s of this one. She was a social worker and then later went on to get her PhD, of these children in Los Angeles. And she went back 10 years later and saw that a third of them were still suffering. And she was a prolific writer and, you know, was still blogging for Huffington Post, you know, a handful of years ago before she died. It's this one study. And if you look on Focus on the Family, you know, a Christian organization in Colorado Springs, that's the study they have on their website. And nobody else comes up with those. Nobody else comes up with that. There's been, many researchers doing these longitudinal studies where you follow a family and then you check in 5 years and 10 years and 20 years later, and they all come up with about 80% of children of divorce do fine and show no lasting negative effects, on their school or their emotional well-being or their ability to form close relationships. That 80%, 20% of kids of divorce suffer, you know, and ongoing challenges. Only 10% of kids in intact families suffer these same challenges, you know, using these kinds of behavioral indicators. So there's definitely a difference there, that the rate is higher with divorce, and there's two ways to look at that. And one is that divorce is a risk factor. You know, if you have a bad marriage, you know, you're fighting, you get divorced, you're fighting more, you're moving from house to house, you're unable to recuperate, you know, these kinds of things absolutely will impact your children. But, you know, I talk about, we do a lot of things that are risk factors, like driving a car. You know, you're at risk for getting in an accident, so we take driver's education, we wear a seatbelt. And if you're parenting, you're a parent and you're getting divorced, you want to really pay attention to your emotional well-being and how your children are doing and create stability. So that is part of it, but it's more of a risk factor. And then, you know, absolutely, times have changed. When my parents divorced in 1973, it was very uncommon. There was a lot of stigma. There weren't a lot of kids in the class who had divorced parents. There were some kids I wasn't allowed to play with because I had divorced parents. So my mother went back to school and got her bachelor's degree, but, you know, wasn't working when she got divorced. You know, it was a very different era. And now 50% of adults in many major cities live alone. We have many single parents. We have single parents by choice. We have same-gender couples or transgender couples. The landscape, the family landscape is so different. The typical American family is so atypical, is so varied. So for a child, you know, I talked to many sort of teenagers or older teens who said, well, you know, I've seen a lot of divorces around me. It seemed sort of like a natural step. Or some kids said, you know, I was relieved because they were fighting so much. I felt better. Somebody told me about his parents getting back together after they separated, and he was so upset because he didn't want to have to go back into that home of fighting.
I appreciate what you had to say about loneliness and how, particularly in the first year after you and your husband separated, you, in your words, would find yourself swept by loneliness. It would disperse, then gather anew, building up outside the house, pressing in the walls, bowing the windows. Loneliness is like an emotional barometric pressure, rising, rising. And you have a very interesting observation about how loneliness also feels so risky because of what loneliness once upon a time used to represent, which helps explain why loneliness or abandonment can be one of the most frightening sensations a human being can have. Explain to our listeners what I'm mentioning here.
I'm interested in evolutionary psychology. You know, I have a lot of that in here. You know, what I'm having this feeling, what might this feeling come from, you know, in the history of the human animal. So when we talk about loneliness, boy, there's so much research about loneliness. This is such a big topic in our culture. And evolutionary psychologists will say, in the past, if you were alone, it was very risky. You had lost the protection of the group. And loneliness was like this warning signal, like, hey, your social circle has gotten too small. You don't have the protection. You know, this is a risk. You need to quickly rejoin the group. You could get attacked by a lion, and you don't have the people around to protect you. And it feels like that, right? I mean, for me, it felt like that. I was home alone. My son was asleep. Nobody was visiting. I'm in this house by myself. You know, my ex-husband was off with his girlfriend in the city, and I just was so, this feeling of, like, this is untenable, this is unacceptable, and it's dangerous. And so this idea of it would have been dangerous in the past, but, you know, in fact, if I had had some medical emergency, I could call 911. You know, if I had a cold, you know, if I have a cold, I can actually get soup ordered from the diner. I can, you know, there's so many ways in which the fabric of our society is so much more strongly knit. You know, when you're alone, you're not really alone, and it's not risky, but it still, we still have that evolutionary feeling of risk.
Right. And of course, you have all over the book various strategies by which somebody can not only cope with that sort of emotional sense of loneliness, but also really tangible ways in which one can kind of rebuild one's social circle and rebuild maybe connections that might have grown a little more difficult in the wake of this. Of course, your whole book, in a sense, this is how we'll close, is about sort of fostering new and healthier ways to think about divorce and to maybe also formulate better ways of talking about it. At one point, you talk about how someone maybe should think about writing what you call a divorce elevator speech for themselves. Explain to our listeners what this would represent and how it could be helpful.
I was lucky to talk about my divorce and, you know, how is this going to go over? I was 45. I had a little kid. Now I'm single. And I took this vacation to Mexico and I got to test drive, you know, talking about it away from my home environment. And people were very enthusiastic and it's going to be great. And I wish you well. And, you know, it was so helpful. And then I came home and had this experience of going out to dinner with a friend and her mother. And the mother was, you know, asking me, well, why are you getting divorced? Are you sure you need to get divorced? What was wrong, really? And I wound up just sort of building this case against my ex-husband because I felt really defensive. And, you know, well, he didn't listen to me. You know, and I wound up saying things I didn't even mean because I was unprepared and I didn't have a prepared speech. And, you know, I think the mom meant well, but, you know, you're feeling vulnerable, you're feeling insecure, you know, you don't know what's going to happen next. And anyway, so I said negative things about myself and about him, and I got home and thought, okay, I need to have a way of talking about this that will appease someone's curiosity and get me out of this conversation before I start saying things I don't want to say. And another thing I talk about is emotional contagion, which is how we talk about something affects the reaction that we get, affects the feedback that we get. So, you know, if you I have a whole thing on emotional contagion. So if you, you know, if you start saying, you know, if you share only your lowest moments, you know, in your darkest times, your friends are going to pick up your tone of voice, your body language, your furrowed brows, and they're going to say back to you, oh, that's right, that's really difficult, you know, it must be terrible. And you don't want to be in a situation like that where you're kind of caught off guard. So an elevator speech is a, you know, a thing from business where you have 2 minutes to describe your, you know, your work or your startup if you're seeking funding, you know, and the time it would take you to ride an elevator from the top floor to the ground floor. Like, so you got caught in an elevator, right, with a potential employer, and they say, what do? And you don't want to be like, oh, you know, nothing, I'm unemployed. You know, you want to be able to say, well, in my last job, I turned around the company. So, you know, it does matter in divorce. It's part of this, you know, the book talks a lot about narrative in general and how the stories we tell ourselves and tell others can help us live into the life that we want or really kind of keep us trapped. So, you know, not, I don't mean being dishonest, but I do mean, you know, the conversation with a stranger or with your children's teacher or the friend's mother, you know, that's not necessarily the, you know, heart-to-heart, soulful conversation about the struggles you're having. That's just a, you know, yes, what I come up with is, yes, you know, we're getting divorced, it's mutual, we really have a vision of a positive divorce, we think it's better for our children, for our child, you know, we're really trying to not take sides, we're asking our friends not to take sides, and hey, now I'm single, do you know anyone you could fix me up with? You know, a way to sort of get the conversation to move to something more positive, or, you know, hey, you know, to a you know, another parent at school, you know, I have my child Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and we're looking for play dates. Let's make a play date. You know, a way to answer their question, appease their curiosity, and then give them a task they can do to help you.
Right. And we should mention that you also, in your book, talk about the ways in which one might approach your own parents or your in-laws or your own children in announcing the divorce. And you give some really, really good advice on all that. And I especially love the story you tell about the really beautiful experience you had with your in-laws when they finally learned for the first time that that their son and you were going to be divorced. They were devout Catholics. Marriage was very important to them. And yet their love for you and their concern for you was even more important to them than maybe their own cherished beliefs about marriage and divorce. So I really appreciate all of that. In this chapter, you talk about honesty, and I think you speak about it in a way that, again, transcends even the topic we're talking about today. You write at one point, and I think this is so valuable in this age of Facebook, among other social media tools, honesty is good policy, but indiscriminately sharing only our darkest moments can lead to depressing and harmful feedback from otherwise caring friends, and certainly from those who are not intimates. Emotional flexibility, it turns out, is the better way, better approach during stressful times, and a skill set that some of us need to cultivate. Explain to our listeners what emotional flexibility is and how valuable it can be.
We have such an emphasis on being honest, and this is great. You know, this is great. We don't want to be a face-saving culture. You know, you don't want to always be saving face. That leads to plenty of problems. But there's also something about, you know, self-control and forbearance and a recognition of this emotional contagion. And, you know, if you say only the most negative thing, that's the feedback you're going to get. And it isn't true that the worst thing you say is really your deepest truth. You know, people will get in these fights, right? And it'll get worse and worse. And this happens in marriage. It'll escalate. And then, you know, finally somebody will say something really horrible, like, I didn't mean to marry you. I loved your sister, or whatever. You know, like the worst thing you could possibly think of. And the other person will say, aha, you he told me the truth. Now I really know. But that's not the real truth. It's a mistaken understanding. You know, when your emotions are inflamed and you're reaching for the meanest, most hurtful thing you can say, that's not the real truth. That's a misunderstanding. The idea that that's the real truth is a misunderstanding. And additionally, the idea that we need to share every single thought all the time. I'm just sort of starting to try to learn a little bit about marriage. Like, I know how to have a good divorce, and now I'm, interested in, how would one have a good marriage? And this idea, we have this idea that I need to tell my spouse every single thought I have, and, particularly every negative thought about him or about her, and that isn't really super functional. I developed a lot of skills in my divorce and being able to say, I'm going to write down on a piece of paper, all of these negative thoughts, and then I'll say them next week. I'll wait and see how I feel, and what really needs to be said, isn't the, every single thought you're having right that minute.
I really appreciate that sort of nuanced notion of what real honesty is, and especially the most helpful and healthy way we can think about honesty. At one point you write, divorce isn't anyone's plan A. Still, it's possible to create a meaningful, fabulous plan B. And we should mention that the last part of the book sort of details some of the ways in which a very positive and indeed wonderful new chapter can be built. And that's just scratching the surface of this extraordinarily rich and intriguing book that you have written called Splittopia, Dispatches from Today's Good Divorce and How to Part Well, published by Atria Books and the author, Wendy Paris. Wendy Paris, I think you've done a great service to all kinds of people in the way you've written this book, and I so appreciate you joining me today on the morning show to talk about your wonderful book. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you so much, you too.
This portion of WGTD's morning show is devoted to, in a sense, the scenario of the Brady Bunch, or closer to our own age, a certain storyline in Modern Family, namely the blending of families, the step-parenting challenge, which does not get talked about enough, although it is certainly a reality for more and more families. And a very thoughtfully crafted book has just been written called Blending Families, Merging Households with Kids 8 to 18. And I'm going to be speaking with one of the two authors of the book, Trevor Crowe Mullineaux, who is a licensed marriage and family therapist and a co-author of an earlier book called Forging Healthy Connections. In this new book, Blending Families, she and her co-author explore a number of different ways in which step-parenting can be a tremendous challenge and also a tremendous blessing, incredibly fulfilling and satisfying and joyous. But it is not always, in fact, maybe not often, an easy, effortless path. And they have included many real-life examples and stories about step-parents and Trevor Crowe Mullineaux herself has some firsthand experience when it comes to the challenges of step-parenting. And I'm very excited to have this opportunity to speak about this book, which is published by Roman and Littlefield. Trevor Crowe Mullineaux, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
Could you say a word first about your own experience, firsthand experience, in the realm of step-parenting, having both been a step-parent and having been step-parented, so to speak?
You are absolutely correct. So I met my kid's dad, and he had two children, one who is now 27. At the time, she was 6, and her little brother was 3. So we went on to have two children together. So my kids have half-siblings. Unfortunately, that relationship ended. However, I remarried a wonderful, wonderful man, and he has a daughter who's actually graduating today from the Hopkins School here in Connecticut. And so I've blended not only one, but two families, and my children currently have a stepsister, and they have half-siblings. So it's a little complicated.
Right. And one of the things I appreciate about your book is that this is not just a book about I did this perfectly, and so here's how you do it. This is a story that acknowledges a more complicated reality, not only for yourself, but for all these other people that you also talk about who have grappled with the really special challenges of being a step-parent.
Yes, it is. It has its highs and lows like any other family group. But this is particularly tricky. And if you really walk into it with eyes wide open and knowing that there are alliances just naturally with your biological child, and it's hard to create relationships with step or half-sibs, it's really something you have to step into with thinking about it, wanting to be curious, very open-hearted, and with a lot of love and patience. And a little humor helps, too.
I'm really glad that on the second page of the book, you grab hold of what I think some people are kind of sheepish about discussing, and namely what you were just saying, that there is a difference between the relationship between a biological parent and their biological child and a step-parent and their stepchild, right from the beginning, on a sort of fundamental animal way, is the way that you say it. In fact, you describe the way in which your first child, your own biological child, you tell us, smelled like flowers to me. And this is something you tell us that is, in a sense, hardwired for the typical parent. And that is something, of course, that is not going to exist in quite the same way with even the most loving, devoted step-parent.
Absolutely. And, you know, that is part of the challenge and the complicated nature of all this, and also the feeling of great joy and love when you create a relationship with a child that you aren't biologically, you know, there is no DNA connection, yet we all can show up for each other. And how wonderful if we look at it from the child's perspective of, here's yet another adult who wants to love me and show up for me and listen and, you know, help with the resources, whether it's time or money or just, you know, watching the lacrosse game to feel like people are caring about me. So I really feel like it's made me grow as a person. I love my family and that all of these kids, whether they're related by blood or not, do literally show up for each other. Right now at this graduation, I've got the 27-year-old at the 17-year-olds, and there's no blood between these two, but they're sisters, and they really do care about each other. So this is what I think, even though we're hardwired for this sort of animal connection, if we mindfully walk into the blending situation with this sort of love and patience and understanding that it's some work, and it's not, maybe not a natural connection. It's something you have to try for. But it can be really great, and it's very rewarding, actually.
Right. I think that's one reason why at one point in the author's note you call it the blending adventure. and probably for somebody who's grappling with maybe the harsher realities of it, or maybe trying to blend under less than ideal circumstances, it might not feel like an adventure. But in fact, this is what it can be, especially when it's done well. In addition to being a step-parent yourself in a couple of different scenarios, you have also been, in a sense, step-parented. And I wonder if you could just say a word about what you saw in the relationship between your own mother and the man that she later married when you were in your mid-20s, a man named Howard Stevenson. It sounds like you've taken great inspiration from the way in which they step-parented.
And they continue to do so, by the way. They're they've been together, 27, 28 years now, and they're a brilliant role model for me. And both Howard and my mom have been so loving. We really do have a Brady Bunch. There's four of us girls, and then my mom married Howard, who had three sons. We all never lived in the same house at the same time, but the two youngest, my younger sister and his youngest son, Andy, spent much more time in the house. What I saw and what I learned, and I still take inspiration from today, is the two of them made their couple the focus and the strong, boundaried foundation for the whole story. And they were very careful to be as fair as possible, as loving as possible and giving us resources again, whether it's money or time or advice. And they strived for that every step of the way. And, it, you know, of course, none of these things are ever perfect. But what they did really, really well is they never undermined each other. They always, you know, if you asked a question or pushed, you know, my biological mom on something, she always was like, nope, Howard and I are in a team. We're not going to separate on this. This is a decision we made together. So to me, that's the strongest, best way to start the blend, is it's really got to be in a couple where you love each other and you're just, you've got to, and I, this is a really tough thing to say, and a lot of people kind of wince when I say it, but you actually have to choose your spouse over your biological child over time. Because in the end, our kids are supposed to leave, just like any family, you know, whether it's an intact biological family or not. And we're forgetting, I think, especially in our culture today, that the couple, we need to nurture our relationship together, us one-on-one, two together, and then the children will all be safer, stronger, connected. If there's sort of this bringing the child up into the parental subsystem, it gets very waffly and unsafe and frankly dangerous. And it's not good for the child. It's not good for the couple. So my parents really did that. There really has been a hierarchy. You know, we're a team. You kids are not going to come between us, but we're going to show up when we can and the best we can and in a very loving way. So that's been a great role model and really truly has been set the stage for the way I've viewed and helped, you know, create these three families that I've been working with.
We're speaking with Trevor Crow Milano about her book, Blending Families, Merging Households with Kids 8 to 18. You say as the introduction opens that in a sense you choose to become a step-parent. In a way that becoming a biological parent is not always quite the same clear choice. I mean, obviously, to some extent, most of the time, there is some element of choice involved. But in your words, step-parenting reflects a conscious decision to form a family with children whose personalities you didn't help shape when they are little. They are children who do not have your genes. There is a lot you don't know about them physically, emotionally, and psychologically. In so many ways, they are strangers. I really appreciate the frankness with which you say that as well, because that's a reality that probably a lot of people in writing books like this probably are tempted to sort of dance around. And maybe people who live through this reality are also tempted to kind of dance around that reality. Strikes me as much healthier to sort of take that reality head on and be honest about it right from the start.
Well, thank you for that. And I did want to be really clear about this, that this is not a Pollyanna story, and it's very tricky and difficult for many, many people. And I've counseled families who are really coping with some difficult issues. But I do want it to be a very hopeful book, hopeful from the perspective of love is elastic. And as we show love to one another and we create a sense of safe haven in our homes where everyone belongs, everybody feels safe, everybody feels seen and heard and valued, that you actually create a great deal of healing for all of those individuals. And remember, when you're starting a blend, it's always from loss, whether a parent has died or there's been a divorce or a parent just abandoned or just never showed up. So there's a lot of healing that needs to happen. And if you can step into this whole story with this sort of sense of, yeah, you may not know these children, but if you give them a chance to grow and thrive and love them and show you really care and you're curious, I really believe that we can create these little tiny communities that can be so powerful and warm and loving. And that's really, to me, the rewarding and great point of all this.
The first part of the book, called Opportunities and Challenges, includes an exploration of different kinds of attachment styles. And this is really, really interesting, and it includes a questionnaire that you invite the reader to take. And the way we answer these 10 questions can help us understand what our own attachment style might be. And I hasten to add that one's attachment style might be different in terms of your attachment style with your romantic partner versus your attachment style with, for instance, your children or your stepchildren. Explain this notion of attachment style, the different possibilities that are there, and why it's so important for us to know this about ourselves if we are about to embark on the adventure of step-parenting.
Well, we all develop an attachment style in 0 to 2 when our caregiver showed up for us or didn't. And given the nature of our own personalities, the environment, and how that person was responsive to us, we create, it could be a secure attachment, so you're healthy and secure within yourself. You could be anxious, which is you're always pursuing, you're never quite satisfied, you get very reactive if people don't reassure you. Or you can be an avoidant, have an avoidant attachment style, which means you really push your emotions down. You don't really identify what's really happening. You tend to step away. You freeze or flee when things are happening. You kind of go numb, and you can't really be responsive because your own feelings have been so pushed down inside you. So that's an avoidant. And then the last attachment style is called chaotic. It's both of those things, the anxious and the avoidant coming together, which is, we call it come to me, go away. So if you're parenting from one of these attachment styles other than secure, if your child, if you're an anxious parent, for example, and your child is like pushing you away, trying to be a little bit more independent, saying, look, I need to go meet with my friends, and I'm developing my feeling of who I am out in the community, this around the 13, 14-year-old, 12-year-old adolescent stage. And an anxious parent may not really welcome that. They may feel rejected by the child or abandoned by the child, and they might pursue the child to come back and stay with them more often than they, please spend more time with me. But that's hard on the child as they're trying to create their own identity outside of the house. Now, a withdrawing, avoidant parent doesn't really talk to the child much about emotions because they're really not in touch with their own. The child might be in crisis, and the avoidant parent really doesn't have any tools to reach in and say, I see you're having trouble. Come to me. Let's talk. Let's name your emotional place so we can resolve it together. An avoidant parent has difficulty connecting that way. So if we become aware of our own attachment styles in relation to our children and in relation to our partners, we really start to understand, I am reactive in this way. I don't have to always react that way. For example, I myself tend to be more of the avoidant type. So in my mind, I have to sort of slow down and go, instead of saying, oh, I can't deal with this anymore, I'm going to walk out, I'm going to get in my car, I'm going to drive down the street because I'm so frustrated. That's my usual style, by the way. I stop and I slow down and I tell myself, use your words. You can say right now you're getting frustrated. You can say to yourself, you can say to your child or even your spouse, I'm actually kind of overwhelmed. I don't even really know what to say. I'm having trouble dealing with this. Or you start to get a little bit more vulnerable and more in touch with your own feelings. And then you bring the conversation to a very different place. Now, the reason why that is so important in a blended family situation is because emotions do get high. There are times when, for example, your spouse may, you feel like your spouse is aligning himself with his son or his daughter over you. And when that threat comes up in a couple, it's very important to really voice it. And as an avoidant, normally I'd be like, oh, well, I'm not going to deal with that, or I'll go, have lunch with my friend, or I'm just, but now I'm trying to teach myself to say, you know what, when you do X, Y, or Z, or you parent your daughter a little differently than my kids, I need you to understand what happens, how it lands on me.
Hmm. Yeah, I have to say,
using my words.
Right. I have to say, by the way, my wife and I happen not to be parents. But as you're talking about these attachment styles, I'm realizing I would probably understand my wife and she would understand me better. And our relationship, which is very strong, very positive, would be even stronger and even more positive if we were mindful of each other's attachment styles. So I can see somebody who's not even a step-parent or even a parent at all really benefiting from maybe exploring this idea of one's own attachment style. And that could have ramifications, I suppose, even beyond marriage to and family, to the way one relates to friends and so on.
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct. And we certainly learned since the mid-90s, there's a brilliant woman named Sue Johnson who has created emotionally focused therapy for couples. It's the only well-established, well-researched, evidence-based couples therapy that really addresses these attachment styles and helps couples calm down, have compassion not only for their own reactivity, but be able to step away and kind of go, oh, I see that's happening. My wife gets, you know, her reactivity is she gets very anxious and elevated and escalated. And I can meet her when she gets to that place. I can reassure her and say, I'm here, honey. Let's bring it down together. I can show up for you in those stressful moments. So, yes, and a lot of Sue Johnson's and attachment theory is very much influenced, you know, my style of therapy, but also this book.
Right.
So I owe a great credit to her.
I appreciate the matrix at one point that's shared about the three main young characters in the Harry Potter books, Hermione Granger and Ron Weasley and Harry Potter, as being, in a sense, examples of secure attachment style. That would be Hermione, Ron being the anxious, ambivalent type, and Harry being a bit more avoidant. And it's kind of fun to read what you say about that. And then you go on to talk about how this can have ramifications in terms of the way one tends to parent and the way in which one's parenting is seen. Is it more valuable to be mindful of one's own attachment styles, or does one also need to think about the children and their own attachment styles as well?
Well, if you get pretty good at recognizing your own reactivity and being able to say, okay, right now I can feel myself getting, and this is actually a checking in on your physical experience, because all of our emotions register in our bodies first. If you can stop and slow down and go, oh, I feel my stomach going into knots right now. Okay, before I actually start reacting in my normal way, whether it's withdraw or yell or whatever it is you usually do, you stop and slow down and go, okay, here's where I'm at. I can take a deep breath. And then the next piece, which is, you know, it's a skill set and it takes a while. This is the 10,000 hour rule. Once you get to that place of sort of self-compassion, you can kind of check in and go, okay, what's happening with this child now? And that's important. That's a very important piece of this, which is if you know their styles and you're able to get them to understand their own stuff because you have compassion, now you have compassion for them, they learn and grow and they can handle their, again, back to this like emotional resiliency, we're all much stronger and healthier when we can voice what's really happening for us in this very clear, authentic, vulnerable way. And if you create that safe place for that child to speak their truth, everybody grows. And it's a great feeling, and I'm always trying to work on it because there are days when you're like just really mad at them, and you're like, you did what? But if you can calm down and go, okay, so what's the context? Give me what was going on for you. Why did you make those choices? Let me listen open-heartedly to this before I go really ballistic.
Right.
It can be hard.
Right. Speaking of being hard, I really appreciate the chapter in which you explore what you see as five of the most fundamental challenges that are part of this blending families process. And boy, they make a lot of sense. Putting the couple first can be very, very tricky. Resolving parenting differences, I suppose that's parenting styles and the different choices that different parents make. Communicating stability to the children, given the fact that, as you say repeatedly, most step-parenting situations are actually born of some kind of trauma, setting the boundaries of step-parenting, and finally, establishing equality where there is inequality. I think all five of those right on the surface make a lot of sense, and of course, it's good to read about more of the details, except the last one. I think the last one is the least obvious of the five. Can you explain what the significance is of this balance between equality and inequality?
Well, one of the big issues between, you know, putting a set of siblings, step-siblings together is each of those families come from, they have different rituals, different values in many ways. And you have to celebrate the differences rather than judge the differences. So I like to call it like my stepbrothers are really great. They love kayaking and biking, and they're very much into green energy and responsible environmental sort of approach to the world. They have all these really great ideas, and I've learned a lot from them. And me and my sisters are all tend to be more, oh, we love to travel, and we wear fancier clothes, and we really don't go camping generally. And so we've loved and enjoyed a different kind of a style, if you will. And one of the things my parents have strived to do is say, oh, there's differences, but there's no better. You guys aren't better than the girls, or vice versa, that we celebrate those differences, and we're not going to create an unequal situation. And remember, some step families come together, and there can be a very giant financial difference between those two families. And so being sensitive to where your children are, how each sort of family group comes together, and understanding where maybe one might feel insecure or another might feel unsure, that you're just very attuned to how those differences can manifest, and reassure the kids that we're not going to pay attention to those. We're going to love you guys for who you are and celebrate and support those interests and those ambitions and drives. And cool, we're going to support that and go forward, but we're not going to set up they're better because they're, you know, vegan or something. I don't know. But the kids are hyper aware of these differences. So just being aware of that, and you'll be fine.
Right. This brings to mind something that gets talked about more than once in the book. That is contrasting two different television programs that each depict blended families, but in such mm-hmm. different fashion, namely the Brady Bunch from the late 1960s, early 70s, and of course a program that's on the air right now, Modern Family, which many of us watch and love. And maybe we mm-hmm. watched and loved the earlier show too, but the one really pays only the slightest attention to the reality of blending two families together. I mean, most of the time it could be just two parents with six kids and what happens, you know, with boys and girls and living in the same house. But Modern Family, in a sense, takes a much more nuanced, detailed, realistic approach to just how messy this blending process can be when you have different peoples making different assumptions and so on. I really appreciate that because, you know, in a nutshell, it helps us understand just how complicated yet how wonderful all this can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to embrace the mess.
Let's finish by talking about five musts to succeed: trust, vulnerability, empathy, truthfulness, and structure. And was it hard to come up with this list of five, or did they present themselves very naturally and effortlessly to you?
I think between Marianne and I, we've worked together on now two books. You know, she was saying, we really need to structure this in a way. And so, like, these are some very clear points that help people, you know, create a structure to build upon. And that once we started talking that way, they sort of flowed out in a really easy manner. And when those five points are in place, you can feel the strength of it. And the kids feel it, I believe, too. And that's how you, and as long as, you know, you're embracing the mess, but also being able to adapt and to listen and to care, it all comes together, and it's fine and wonderful. Yes, there's always going to be messy moments, but again, it's doable. And that's why I really want everybody to understand there's a very hopeful piece of this.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I appreciate how this part of the book really goes into some detail about each of these concepts, which we're all familiar with, but sometimes turning those terms on their head or really helping us think about them in different ways. I want to finish by asking you about something that might surprise people a little bit. It's this notion that gets said more than once that if you're right about 30% of the time, probably mm-hmm. things are going to be okay. Tell us where that comes from.
Well, a guy named Ed Tronick has done some really wonderful research around attachment styles and parenting. And if anybody wants to look on YouTube, there's a wonderful video called Still Face Experiment. And it's heartbreaking. But take a look at it, because that works even in adult relationships when you don't when you kind of shut down and don't relay that there's this mom and a baby and there's a dance and the mom just shuts down and the baby, just can't deal with it and starts to cry and just makes you cry. But we even do this in adult relationships. Anyway, pass.
Coming up on 9 o'clock, with a reminder, support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha